Well, I'm going to tell you about our attempt at trying to understand what one means by robustness in transcription control, and what robustness might, well, maximization of robustness might imply for organization of simple transcription control architectures, simple, relatively simple, meaning bacteria. So, and my collaborator is my colleague at Bell Labs, Anirvan Singupta. And I'm going to start with an introduction. Actually, I'm going to skip the introduction because you heard about control of gene expression last week from people who know 10,000 times more about it than I do. But maybe I'll just do enough of this to synchronize the terminology and sort of articulate the questions. So then I'll jump into the modeling aspect of transcription control. And our model basically be built on the model of transcription factor DNA recognition event. And I'll give you a rather general definition, quantitative definition of robustness of a transcription control architecture. And then we'll compute robustness for transcription factor DNA recognition link as a function of factor specificity, and take this optimization of robustness seriously. And actually, I'll give an argument for why one should, I'll give an evolutionary argument for why one should conceivably think about optimizing robustness. And that will, in the context of bacterial, sort of relatively simple control architecture, spit out a simple prediction relating sort of the optimal specificity of the factor to its degree of pleiotropy, meaning the number of regulatory targets of that factor. And finally, we'll attempt to reality check and go and dig in genomic data on E. coli transcription factors, looking for correlation between the specificity of a factor and its degree of pleiotropy. So I suppose if I were giving a talk for a biology audience, I would have started by first declaring my organism, which would eventually end up here as E. coli, and then try to generalize from whatever observations we might have there. But for better or worse, I'm going to start with a fairly abstract model and try to make a prediction and then move to comparison in some simple case. So my very, very brief introduction is going to be just to remind you that the way gene expression is controlled in the cell is, of course, complicated. There are transcription factors, which are proteins, which control the initiation of transcription. And well, being proteins, of course, these factors are products of genes, so there is a feedback loop there. And in order to initiate their activity, well, factors often have to be activated or translocated into a nucleus or some such thing, and that is very often affected by external signals. So we are going to think of only one part of this system. Basically, flow of information from transcription factors to genes. So already, you know, the complex network got brutally reduced to merely what in neural network literature is referred to as feed-forward network. So we have transcription factors, which regulate genes, and a single factor might be regulating multiple genes, and a single gene might be regulated by multiple factors. And as you know, already this link can be very, very complex. You saw it last week in Davidson's talk. So here is an upstream regulatory DNA of some particular gene in sea urchin, and that contains lots and lots of binding sites, actually all given here, which bind various transcription factor proteins of different flavors. And the whole thing is broken up into modules, each of which requires simultaneous presence and activity of a number of proteins, and each of which directing the expression of the gene under some particular circumstances. So the caricature that comes along with it looks like this. There are sort of segments of this long promoter. I'll refer to this whole regulatory region as a promoter. And this little tidbit we'll call a response element. So that's the tidbit of DNA to which a factor binds. And well, a bunch of factors might assemble cooperatively on some subset of these possible binding sites and instruct the polymerase to either proceed or not, as the case might be. So in that famous paper, Davidson and collaborators talk about promoter logic, which I at least understand as a sort of symbolic description of the function of these modules, well, in terms of ands and ors, on well, meaning that factor A, C, and D are simultaneously present. So complicated. What do we want to know? Of course, the million-dollar question in the subject is to devise ways of efficiently discovering these complex regulatory structures. Some quick way of determining exactly the dependence of the transcription activity of a gene on the factors, you know, from the data. As on the other hand, just as Andrew was emphasizing on Monday, one also wonders about some general principles of transcription control. And in particular, one often thinks of these control architectures as being robust in some fairly intuitive sense, and evolvable. And I'm just paraphrasing Andrew. one wonders what sort of constraints these properties, you know, at the moment still vaguely defined, imply on the architecture of this transcription control mechanism. So where we want to be is somewhat in the middle of these two extremes. So we want to formulate and contemplate some grossly simplified but hopefully still plausible phenomenologically models of the process. And we want to keep enough connection with reality so that you know, we can ask questions about robustness and evolvability. And well, ideally understand what constraints this imposes on the models and use these constraints eventually to restrict the number of hypotheses that one will use to fit the data. In, well, I confess right away, we're very far from being there. We're just making very first few steps. So I'll be able to define what we mean by robustness, and I'll have nothing to say yet about evolvability. But even so, we'll be able to make some predictions which are falsifiable, and hopefully not false. But I must be doing something wrong because everybody's so silent. All right.
Well, so, the sea urchin example, is that just one, the only example known, is it's fairly universal, the whole setup?
Well, there are a few examples known. There are a few examples that are known in such great detail.
Some kind of N or logic?
Very approximately, you have to realize. Like in Drosophila, yeah. Right. So, for example, one other very good example is you know, a certain gene in Drosophila which is responsible for making stripes, and it makes 7 stripes, and different modules are responsible for different stripes. And it is sort of somewhat surprising for a physicist because you know, it's sort of a periodic pattern, and you would like to think that it's periodic. But in fact, the way it works is different modules are responsible for different stripes. So, okay. So I'm just going to remind you these so 3 levels of organization of this control structure. The first is factor DNA interaction, the recognition of by the factor of a particular segment in the promoter, this response element sequence, and roughly what is recognized is this factor has its favorite sequence, and the response element sequence should be in some sense not too far from it. The next level of organization is the cooperative assembly or competition of these different factors on in the promoter region. So very crudely, this logical function. And the last level of organization is this feedback from genes back to factors, and as I already said, we are not going to think of that. So let me formulate this model that we want to think about. So think of the input into this control network. Well, the input into this control network is provided by concentrations of various factors. And let us take a sort of a low-resolution view of it. So we'll say that a given factor has some characteristic physiological concentration at which it is active. And we'll call that high concentration. And if it's if the factor concentration is much lower, or it is active factor concentration is much lower, or it is absent, we'll denote that by the low concentration symbol. And similarly, we will view the pattern of gene activation in this low resolution binary limit just as low or high. And what we want this network to do is to generate some correct patterns of transcription activity in response to certain patterns of factor activity. And Yes, absolutely. I don't quite want to declare it a Boolean network because factor concentrations are going to come back and plague us. You have me. This, of course, was completely random, but let's interpret it. So I think in this circumstance, you will want to say that this little logical gate here requires the activity, simultaneous activity of this factor and that factor.
Activity, or the other is a not gate.
Well,
if this is zero and that is zero,
look, I think this we can explain with an AND gate.
Do the arrows actually denote a potential activation, or they denote a connection? What do we see here? Like if G2 is zero and F3 is zero, what does it mean about the two?
Hang on for 1 second, because I'll give it a completely operational definition that even the computer will understand. Well, look, this was colored at random, I confess. So what the question that you're asking is known as, I guess, is it called assignability problem? It's actually a problem in computer science, whether you can devise a logical function which will implement how to devise a set of gates to implement a logical function. Well, right, of course, right, there are feedback loops and there are multiple layers, but... Right, of course. So you can say that this is also a transcription factor eventually, and it has another branch hanging off it. Sure.
Actually, some of the genes, the proteins coded by some of these genes could be some of the ends.
Precisely.
Right, we don't.
Precisely.
Know that this is not
the precisely. That's... No, I don't want to say that it's neglected. I mean, you don't, it is not considered. It's just that, you know, we can define a perfectly, this is a well-defined problem. It is not the whole story, right? Precisely because there are these feedbacks and so on and so forth. But it will suffice for the question that we want to ask. So you have already asked me what those errors mean. So let's explain in detail. So first, let's think more precisely about this single elementary link of the network, the interaction of a factor with a response element. So response element has some sequence of bases, and the transcription factor has domains which interact with these bases, and there is some interaction energy which depends on what base sits at what position. So let's say that the factor interacts with base alpha at position I with some energy epsilon, and let's say that the total interaction energy is just the sum over all positions. So let me first explain the notation here. I guess I hopefully consistently will be denoting x of an underscore sort of a Boolean representation of a sequence where x is equal to 1. X alpha sub I is equal to 1 if base alpha sits at site I, right? So then we can nicely write down this linear superposition, and in the rest of the talk I'll just be referring to this linear superposition as x dot E. So the definition once and for all. Right. So remarkably, this very naive linear picture is not ridiculous, and people have done experiments, and it is a reasonable approximation. There are well-documented exceptions where there's clearly dependence on the context, and the energy will depend on the pair of bases. But we know how to start from this and to improve on it systematically by adding interactions. So, and incidentally, it is essentially this parameterization of factor promoter interaction which is used in virtually all bioinformatic analysis of these response elements. And it goes back to Berg and von Hippel, and used by Stormo and Staden, and in fact I think you probably heard about it here more than once. I'm sorry?
If you put in all what you say, there are cases where you can't fit it by a simple model, but if you put in the interactions, you can fit.
Yes.
And so,
yes.
So it seems to me that the number of interactions relative to the number of factors and so forth goes up enough such that I would worry or be interested in knowing what happens to the disease of the treatment.
I'm not entirely sure what you mean. Look, if I understand your question correctly, if we only have sort of a few examples of, if we only look at the interaction of the factor with few examples of a sequence, right? We'll measure, you know, the affinity to a few sequences, you know, 5 sequences, right? And here we're going to have, I don't know, 80 parameters. Hmm? No, sorry. Sorry. For the, you know, for bacterial factors, more often than not, they will bind as dimers, right? And you know, this site, all told, will be 15, 20 bases. Well, let's say 8. So, you know, so these binding sites typically look like, you know, roughly 8 and 8 with a little spacer. Okay. So, I'm still not sure that I understood your first question and whether I answered it. But well, you know, I think it depends how, you know, how much data you have to fit. In principle, there are 4 to the 16 or 4 to the 20 sites that you know, one could construct and measure affinity for, and so you can certainly come up with more data than the parameters here. So the model is well defined. In practice, typically you fit this data to you know, 5 or 10 examples of binding sites, and then you are potentially over-parameterizing.
But your motivation for doing this, as you actually showed on the previous slide, but didn't say, is that you're going to explore the robustness of the mutation.
Right.
And so this gives you a measure for
precise.
The practice mutation.
Precise.
So the sequence information is sitting in the epsilons and the
epsilon. Is sitting in the epsilon, absolutely. So what we want is you know, some compact, well-defined characterization of a factor.
Is X the kind of base or just a name of a base at a particular position?
Ouch. So alpha is the base index. So alpha runs from 1 to 4. And this notation means that, so alpha is kind. And I here is the site, and I'm afraid that what's going to happen to us very shortly is right. I'm going to suppress all these indices, right? And I'll start talking about different binding sites, and there'll be another index, but we'll worry about it when we get there. Okay. Anyway. So, given this interaction energy for a given binding site, we can calculate in equilibrium its probability of being bound to a factor, and it's just given by this right, sigmoidal function, which looks very familiar. So, we are going to actually, just out of laziness, turn this simply into the step function. Oh, oops. I neglected to explain that this binding condition, of course, depends on the concentration of the factor, right? Because that sets the chemical potential, and the binding energy has to exceed the chemical potential. And so instead of working with this Fermi function, we're just going to turn it into a step function. So our binding condition for our condition for binding response element X with factor F is just that the binding energy has to be, or interaction energy has to be below the chemical potential. So very crudely, in the sequence space, And of course, sequence space really doesn't look like that. But very crudely, we're going to denote this by drawing some compact set. Let's call it a sphere, about the favorite sequence that the factor likes to bind, its consensus sequence. And so the size of this sphere is set by the threshold, so by the tolerance factor of the factor. And response elements that are within this sphere will be bound. So we'll say that they're activated, they're on, and the ones that are outside are off.
The justification for hardening the Fermi function, the depth function, is the changes in binding roughly
10 kT? Well, so roughly, I guess, 10 kT for so fairly specific factors. So far, no. Correct. Right. Not yet. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So now I'm going to basically describe algorithmically how we'll go from that to activation of the gene. We're going to say that a promoter of a given gene is characterized by a set of such response elements. And if a response element I, and you see these new index has just appeared. So I'll call it J. So the factor, so response element J will bind, sorry, if response element, never mind, I'm sorry, okay, so if response element J binds factor A, which is to say that this binding condition is satisfied, and this factor is present at the concentration that it is supposed to be at, we'll say that this response element is activated. And you see now I'm going to introduce the capital X, and capital X is a binary variable and just says whether there is this bound state or not. And now, in the spirit of this promoter logic, we're just going to say that depending on which of these response elements are bound, you know, have recruited a factor, the gene is activated or not according to some function, and we'll have some AND conditions which sort of implement the possible cooperativity of you know, required for activation. And we can have some knots to remember that some of these factors will act as repressors, and we'll have some ORs to describe the existence of these different independent modules. Is a question? Sorry. Yes. Yes. Well, you know, so precisely because you know, we decided to do this as a binary, so this concentration is no right. We're not really thinking of concentration as varying continuously, right? You're certainly right. So strictly speaking, what we should be doing is we should forget this and just vary mu. But right, the chemical potential. But instead, what we're doing is we're fixing mu at you know, some physiological value, and then we have to tell the system whether we have a factor or not. So it's a fudge. So anyway, so you see that this is this can be explained to the computer very well, and we have defined this bunch of functions, and we know. And together with this binding condition, it defines the mapping of input configurations, right? Configurations of factor activity into patterns of gene activation. So think of that function as a phenotype. And this phenotype depends on exactly the sequences, the sequences of all the response elements depends on properties of the factors that are hidden in epsilons. Actually, I also should have included mu's here, because mu is also the property of a factor. And these promoter logic functions, G. So think of all these parameters as the genotype, and they are hidden in the definition of this function. Excuse me?
Right.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You're right. But in some sense, it is set by other things, right? Sort of outside. Precisely, precisely. But, right. I was afraid that someone would ask. Well, for simplicity, just think that a given response element will, binds only single factor, right? Then we don't need to distinguish. But in reality, essentially, the same response element sometimes binds to more than one, and then we have to remember which factor it binds, and if we do that, then we have to go back and hang sort of not one index here, but two, which we can if we must. Here, it will all be buried in this notation, right? So you'll just say that, so if you have overlapping sites, right? So suppose that these two sites overlap, and, right? And then if one binds a repressor and another binds an activator, then, right, you will have correct representation of, And you write an AND function like this, right? You will represent repression correctly. Yes. No. Yeah. So, but you can find it. You can write it as a logical function, right? You can write it as an AND with a NOT, right?
Yeah.
Which maybe is not so directly connected with
the finding.
Look. I think I can. I think I can. I can actually defend this this conjunctive normal form. But let's do it. Let's do it offline.
By binding to a site I plus 1 is also occluded and nothing can bind to it. So then you define I plus 1 as one and the same site with a slightly more involved kind of behavior. Clearly, if if there is a crosstalk between adjacent sides, this wouldn't hold unless you coalesce the sides.
I think I disagree with that. Yeah.
Is there another transparency problem which explains this one, or this is the algorithmic definition?
This is just an algorithmic definition.
Okay, but this is it.
Yeah, this is it.
Okay, so let's go back to the definition of capital X sub J. Maybe we should see.
No, no. Yeah, I'm ready.
So if the sub of A.
I'm sorry?
If the xj is wja times xa. I'm just trying to think
how
I write a computer program.
Yes.
So we have several of these f's, right?
Yes.
This is summation over a is implied there, and then it's thresholded or what?
Yes.
Do you understand my question?
Yes.
So strictly speaking, what's in that line is not correct. There's a theta function on it.
Yes.
This is the same question I asked before.
Yes.
Same
well, you don't have to. You don't have to put a threshold as long as this is my answer to Nuran. As long as a single response element binds only one factor, right? But you can generalize it. Generalize it. Just put right.
Just check whether there is anything
right.
Wrong at all, and
right.
There is
so,
one.
Correct. So in general, you sum over little a, and the sum is a logical sum, which is to say it's an OR sum.
It's a relativistic
Boolean notation. Yes.
One is in the definition of W. There's something between the little x and the big x. Big x is threshold.
Right. So the way it is defined, this is your threshold function. So this is 1 of 0. This is 1 of 0. So this is 1 of 0. So we're okay.
What, is f is 1 of 0?
Yes, f is 1 of 0. Yeah. Well, I think you're asking is, you know, some factors bind as dimers. So if they bind as dimers, we'll just call it dimer, the transcription factor, right? And then it's the chemical potential of the dimer that we're worried about. And
something else is not there, so something else finds stronger and it's there, and it's a compact.
But you have the and not capability in his logic function. Bohr's claim is that he can capture any scenario you consider in this logic function.
Look, ultimately. Look, ultimately, I'm not sure I want to even claim that we can capture any scenario, because, but we can capture many scenarios, and our problem is that in fact we can capture more scenarios than we care to consider. So, I was hoping to show you the next. Okay. No, I mean, look.
Really easy to capture in that
not faithfully. Yeah.
All right, so.
Yeah, you basically have to do that, but in a long
way. They call the coalescence of the sign.
Yeah. Yeah, you can do that. Yeah. Well, you know, if you if you fix the chemical potential, right? If you're only looking at the concentration of the free stuff, right? Then it won't matter. If you fix the number of molecules, of course, they will compete. So, which is basically to say that at relatively high concentration, right? You don't have to worry about. Okay. I think I'm running a little bit out of steam. Let's move on a little bit. You'll let's return to this when you see exactly what role it is or is not going to play in the rest of the talk. Okay, so let's think about mutation. So, of course, there are two kinds of mutations. There are point mutations, and there are large-scale mutations. There are duplications, deletions, inversions, et cetera, et cetera. Let's talk about point mutations. So what's going to happen is that these little response elements are going to hop about in sequence space at random. You can also have mutations in factors which will affect their sequence-specific energy, and that will change their most preferred, most favorable sequence, and will effectively translate this binding sphere again in sequence space. So these events clearly will, are capable of affecting the binding of the factor and the response element. And what we want to select on, of course, is the correct binding of factors to response elements, or rather, correct mapping of factors into these gene patterns. So let's just think of it for, the very simplest function. So we have one factor, one gene, one response element, and you want the gene to follow the activity of the factor, and this interaction is just represented by this epsilon and an X, the single binding condition, and the bottom line is that you select the networks with this configuration, where X binds to F, and if by chance, after a few mutations, X wanders out of this domain, we end up with loss of this link, and let's call that a lethal error. So the gene no longer responds to modulation of that factor. Okay. So just in case you didn't notice my Now, our draconian approximations, I'll remind you. I think we've already discussed all this, right? So we're sort of taking a low-resolution view of the factor activity and the transcription activity. And again, a low-resolution view of this binding condition. And very importantly, there is no kinetics in the model whatsoever at the moment. And also, instead of some decrease in fitness, we'll speak of lethal failure. But I would argue that there is still a baby in the bath, in the sense that perhaps the bath originally contained very many babies, and we'll be happy if there is just one left. Okay. So let me define robustness in its full generality. So we're thinking of different ways that we can implement a given mapping of factor configurations into patterns of gene expression. So think of a population as an ensemble of such networks, each parameterized by, its own set of X's and epsilons, which we collectively call by a genotype. And so how does this population evolve due to mutation? So this is a number of copies of genotype gamma at time t. We'll have some transition possible between different genotypes due to mutation. And then out of the new genotype, we have to select those that still correctly perform our stated mapping, our stated genotype, phenotype mapping, which is basically to say that, again, in the computer, you will generate these mutations, and you'll check if your new network still performs the task correctly, and if it doesn't, if it does, you'll keep it, and if it doesn't, you'll kill it. And there is no growth here, only death. So the population will be decaying asymptotically with some rate. Let's see. So I guess asymptotically, the number of copies of gamma will be reduced by this factor, and gamma is approximately the rate of failure, or the probability of lethal mutation. So in population biology, it is also called mutation load. So in population biology sense, you would say that gamma defines the lowest rate of growth in the population that will sustain a stable population. So clearly, again, in evolutionary sense, the networks with the lowest death rate are going to thrive, going to take over this whole population. And let's just define the robustness as inverse of this death rate.
Isn't that also a function of the complexity of the network?
Absolutely.
It could be not very robust, but it
Well,
and also the more complex it is.
Wait, but all the complexity of the network at the moment is hidden, right?
Right.
It's hidden in the
same complexity.
No.
No. There should be something.
No. You can compute this gamma for any network. For each and every network. It's just that different networks will be characterized by different value of gamma. And furthermore, of course, it will also depend on the task, right? One architecture can be good at implementing one phenotype, but not the other. So all that is hidden in gamma. But now if you start with the ensemble of networks, which are actually different architectures, and let them compete against each other, right? It's the most robust one that will win. And in general, of course, when we started thinking about it, we really wanted to consider mutations that will also change architecture, and you can do it very easily by allowing duplications of response elements and duplications of attach. And that sort of relates to evolvability, et cetera, but ultimately we haven't made as much progress as I'd like there, and this is all that I want to say about it.
Find again each and every one of the variables in the blue equation.
You know what? Let me postpone this because.
Yes. Few words. What they mean?
Okay. So gamma.
No. Blue equation here. Which one?
Sorry. Blue equation here.
Sorry.
Right. So this is just a statement about asymptotic behavior of this evolution, right? So at long times, right, it will converge to some distribution of genotypes, right? And the total number will just be decaying at some fixed rate, right? So if mutations are infrequent, then right, the number of little mutations per generation will be small. This number will be close to one, right? And we're going to expand it, right? And let's see. I guess this is the fraction of this is a surviving fraction, so it is close to one, right? One minus that is the death rate. Sorry, is it? Well, it's okay. Yes, I'll take one more question and two more questions. Right. So, correct. This is not quite actually a very good question. It's not quite population biology that we're doing here, because in population biology you would say that there is some fitness function on the genotype, right? And we would introduce a little factor here saying how rapidly this genotype is procreating. And then typically that fitness function would be a random function, because one knows very little about it, okay? So you end up computing diffusion in some random landscape. We don't want to do that, right? We want to think of this in very specific context, which will become obvious also on the next slide, because I'm just going to give a simple example of this in the context of a single factor and the response element. So Well, think of this as evolution within a neutral manifold. Yes. Not quite. Point mutations will also allow the topology to change.
But you had the assumption that if it went outside your boundary, that they're all stable, but not
considered. Let's come back to that. There'll be a loophole. Okay, I guess we break.
5 minutes break.
I think my attempt to be general generated nothing but trouble. So I will retreat to the simple. Okay, so let's just redo this in the simplest case of a single factor and a single factor response element link, right? So we have this response element X bind to the factor, and this little response element is going, you know, can diffuse due to mutation inside the binding domain with no detriment to fitness. But if it ventures out, then a little organism or the network is dead, right? So here is our diffusion in sequence space in some symbolic notation, and here is our selection condition, which confines this response element to be within the binding domain, and basically, the lowest eigenvalue of this thing gives us the failure rate or the flux of those little response elements out through the boundary. So that's our mutation load. And we define robustness as the inverse of this mutation load. So you notice that robustness here is defined not as a property of a genotype, it is a property of distribution of genotypes, right? It is the property of distribution of genotypes which has equilibrated in the population due to mutations. And so here we're looking at the diffusion in some very simple domain. In the full generality of the previous slide, we would be considering diffusion of genotypes in some very complicated multidimensional domain. So these regions would correspond to a good phenotype, and these regions would correspond to a dead phenotype. Correct. So I'm not saying that it is not a function of genotype. It is not a function of genotype, right? Defined not for a genotype, right? Precisely the point I wanted to make. Right. Distribution of genotypes. Well, eigenfunction, sure. Oh, fine, eigenfunction. I didn't want to use the word. Yeah, absolutely.
You have to start there when you use it, otherwise you start with some configuration that's not going to be
able to do it. Wait.
You talk about the lowest eigen.
Yeah, right.
But the main thing is that you start from, if you start with a particular structure, there is no pathway that doesn't go through this way.
Well, so let's just calculate robustness for the single factor response element. So we argue that the binding depends only on this binding energy, right? This linear function of the sequence. So we should be able to reduce everything to the binding energy. So it is useful to look at the density of states with an ensemble of random sequences. So this is basically the number of sequences with binding energy equal to some value, close to a given value. And if this site is long enough, then for typical random strings, this density of states is going to be essentially Gaussian. And then, of course, there are some very special strings. There is the best binding string, and that sort of corresponds to a consensus sequence. And our binding threshold, set by chemical potential, chops off a tail of the distribution. So these sequences in the tail are bound. And let's define the specificity of a factor as the fraction, the logarithm of the fraction of bound sequences, right? Or the probability that the random sequence will bind to a factor. Of course, it is not random, but this is actually a useful characterization of a factor. Just think of it as a property of a factor, right? We've said that the factor is parameterized by this epsilon, but this epsilon is difficult to measure. What is easier to measure, or at least possible to measure, is the binding of that factor to random oligomers, right? This actually is a measurable quantity, right? You can devise an assay of random oligomers and do some filter binding assay and sort out what sequences bound to the factor present at a given concentration. So, of course, probably more work than anyone is willing to expand on this, but it's measurable. So that's basically why I'm saying that. And of course, the response elements are not random, precisely. They're the ones that have to stay in this region. So anyway, we can reduce our problem to distribution of, looking at the evolution of these binding energies, right? For a given mutation, we can figure out its effect on the binding energy, and we'll end up with the evolution equation for distribution of these binding energies. And it's a simple equation, which actually is an oscillator in disguise. So everything in the world is a quantum oscillator. So, and we want to. Sorry, was there a question? Right. So this represents the drift due to the density of states. Right. There is if the sequence mutates in if there is more phase space at this energy than that. Yes. Correct. Absolutely. And we're boiling it down to one dimension, right? So we're just looking at the shells, right? Oh, I mean, you can calculate anything you want. for this thing. Very low probability because, right, you're sucked in into this region of high density of states. So I think, in fact, in population biology literature, this is called, right, there's Muller's ratchet, right, which is basically the statement that detrimental mutations accumulate, right? There are more ways of being wrong. There are more ways of being away from a consensus sequence that, than being right. So anyway, clearly a problem you can solve in half an hour, and the result is that you'll find that these response element sequences seek phase space. So they will accumulate near the boundary of this binding domain rather than sit at the consensus sequence. So you're very unlikely to find a consensus sequence in any population. And the probability of failure depends on factor specificity. Right, depends on that fraction of bound sequences that I defined on the previous slide. Right. So depends on the volume fraction of this domain in sequence space. And the way it works is that the more specific the factor, right, the smaller this volume is, of course, the higher the rate of failure is. And, well, there is some specific dependence that you find. It goes as a logarithm of the volume fraction. But on the other hand, if the factor is very nonspecific and binds most of phase space, then of course it is exponentially, in fact, unlikely to fail. So this was some formal mumbo jumbo. What can we possibly learn from it? Let's think of a relatively simple mode of transcription control, which actually is what you find in prokaryotes, in bacteria. Roughly, the architecture is, can be described as a master switch architecture. There are factors which control sets of genes or operons forming regulons of different size. There are some small ones, there are some large ones, meaning factor modulating either one operon, as in for a lac operon, or very many operons, as for this catabolic repression protein factor. And if there is redundancy in this control scheme, there is probably rather little of it, in the sense that each of these links is important under some growth condition. You know, it's certainly true that under fixed, in some nice rich medium, perhaps you can delete a large fraction of a genome altogether. But if you consider the variable conditions, presumably most of the genes will be relevant. And in any case, there seems to be rather little redundancy these individual promoters. So for us, this non-redundancy is immediate tremendous simplification, because it is just saying that every link is necessary, and then quite independently of existence of little logical functions here, we will say that every link is necessary. And another fact is that factors appear to have a different degree of specificity. So, for example, a lac repressor is has very few binding sites in the genome, I guess three, and is very specific. Whereas some other transcription factors are quite non-specific and have very many binding sites.
Labs that have only one function, so there's only one side, like you only need one side in front of
it,
and the cap, you can get 100 of the sides, so they could become a multiple function.
Yes.
So just because they're more binding sites than necessarily.
Good. Good. Thank you. So this is precisely right. This is precisely what makes makes the problem non-trivial, right? If these binding sites were random, well, it would be obvious, right, that their number would scale with the volume. To the extent that there is selection, and this is all God's work, you could say that if you need, if a factor needs to, control n genes, you could just replicate n sites. But this is something that robustness considerations can tell us something about. So I'm redrawing the picture. So here are different factors, and they have a different number of regulatory binding sites. So all of these sites are, by assumption, important. And I guess I will I'll be referring to this number of regulatory targets as the degree of pleiotropy of a factor. So the trade word. So obviously, robustness increases with decreasing specificity. So if there was just one factor in the universe and you wanted to make it robust, you would just make it as non-specific as possible. So first of all, there are multiple factors, and you don't want them to crosstalk, so you certainly would not want any one of them to hog all of phase space. But we argue that actually that is not a limiting consideration, and there is something else that we have to worry about. Because there are other tidbits of sequence in these various promoters which, by virtue of their location in the proximity of transcription start, could have regulatory function. So, for example, if a tidbit of the sequence which is a target of a sigma factor also acquires affinity to some repressor, well, it will repress. And that would produce a spurious regulatory effect. So not only you have to keep the flock of response elements inside the binding domain, you actually have to keep the spurious binding sites, of which there are very many, out of this binding domain, right? So the optimal specificity then is found by minimizing mutation load, which consists of two components. The probability of each and every of these AND binding sites to diffuse out, which we do, which they do independently, so that the total failure rate is additive, and the probability of any of the N potential regulatory sites to stay out of, not to bind to response one. Okay, anyway, so you have calculated both of these probabilities, so you can maximize the robustness and find this optimal factor specificity. And you will find that up to logarithms, you want this volume fraction of in sequence space to be proportional to the degree of pleiotropy, to the number of sites. So this looks almost like random, except for the prefactor here. The prefactor here actually has nothing to do, in principle, with the number of binding sites in the random ensemble. Okay. So we want a reality check. So we go to the database compiled at Harvard, which lists binding sites for 55 E. coli transcription factors, and about 500 binding sites. And we estimate this specificity, right, the volume fraction in sequence space, and the number of binding sites for each factor. And we'll look for correlation between the two quantities. And the first thing to notice is the logarithmic scale here. So things are rather scattered. Well, maybe there is some correlation here, but you have to remember that the known binding sites are at best a small fraction, perhaps not a small fraction, but at best a fraction of all the binding sites. So this plot sort of has a status of an exit poll check. Of an exit poll. Yes? Yes. Can I defer this for two slides? Yes. Absolutely. Of course, because, right. Okay, so we sort of try to correct all that by the only means we have, by going back to the genome and looking for more binding sites, which potential binding sites, which look like the ones we know and love. It counts as four binding sites, and the factor of four will be lost on that horrible logarithmic scale. So, right, we can go back and correct for that. So anyway, so we go and we look for more binding sites by you know, some search algorithm, which actually is not quite a standard search algorithm. And if you ask me, I'll tell you exactly what it is. And we find more binding sites, especially for these less specific factors, not surprisingly. So now you clearly start to see some linear asymptote on the log plot. So there is this approximate linearity. Of course, our great difficulty is distinguishing that linearity from what you'd expect in a random ensemble. Because as far as the scaling is concerned, right, you also expect linear scaling in random ensemble. And if our search is completely stupid and has the sites that we find have you know, nothing to do with functional sites, we'll still have linear scaling. Right. So these are known sites, these are potential sites. And yes. And then we spent the rest of 2 months trying to ascertain the significance of these various points. And so the simplest thing to do is, well, try to actually estimate the number you expect in a random ensemble, and that's this straight line. And if you're very optimistic, you'll say that if the number you find is above what you expect in the random, that's significant, and you're done. Unfortunately, the genome isn't really random, and it isn't even homogeneous. And you may not quite believe that estimate of significance. So we did some more conservative test of significance, which basically consists of scrambling the sites and seeing what you find then, and keeping only the sites where you find, well, where you are 3 sigma out of the randomized search. And well, this was supposed to be a color picture. Anyway, so now sites in circles are the ones which are significant by this more conservative test. And well, we lost lots of points, but we still have some, enough to think that there actually is a correlation between the specificity of a factor and number of target sites. Well, you're estimated, it's just that you overestimate it. So what the algorithm actually does is, well, so what happens is you systematically overestimate the specificity of factors for which you have only a few copies. Here. So these things really should move up. And look, one really should be able to do much more here, because you know, in principle, with you know, a little library of potential binding sites, one can go back to the genome and do an experiment and see if these binding sites are functional, and you know, estimate a fraction of right, false positives that that you have here, and you know, not rely on these bioinformatic inferences of significance. So, you know, that would sort of correspond to a manual recount of the data. So, anyway. Since you didn't ask me about the algorithm, I won't tell you. And I'll just give you a flavor. Yes. Yes.
So the range, well, we did some work for also on the trying to look for constraints on the toxicity, and we're using computer mechanical things, constraint on proteins, this protein is using on the genome, and what's the constraint for the time side. What we find is a fixed range, so we would say it's sort of a flat line.
So you have another definition of specificity.
Well, it's sensitive, but if it's too specific, the protein will get stuck. Someone else in the genome will not be able to find it.
Wait. So what you're describing is some theoretical argument.
Yeah.
Right.
As opposed to.
All right. Whether this is okay. So just to give you a flavor of some other things that one can say, for example, we can ask: given that there is a factor with some given degree of pleiotropy, right, which has to bind to n response elements. How rapidly can this whole blob drift in sequence space? So, for example, if you compare two related species of bacteria, where you can find homologous factors and so homologous regulons, you can ask how different are they as far as consensus sequence, and how does this shift in sequence space depend on the number of targets? And intuitively, it is obvious that factors with high pleiotropy are more conserved. That has been stated many times, but we can make this quantitative, and in principle, one should be able to go to the genomic data and try to measure it, but we haven't done it yet. Well, you have to, if you want to describe it with that precision, you have to give a little more information. You have to say, are all of these binding sites necessary, perhaps under different conditions, or are they really redundant? Right. If they're redundant, you want to count one. If they're all necessary, then you want to count all four. So anyway, to summarize, I think I hope I convinced you that it is possible to contemplate relatively simple models, and which still retain rich phenomenology. And it is possible to make falsifiable predictions, and unfortunately, I cannot confidently claim that our prediction is not false. But there's much more that can be done. So we can certainly, and we certainly intend to, pursue these falsifiable predictions, and look at comparison of different species, and try to think about and hopefully find friends to do experiments on factor specificity and on evolution of the factors. And there is much more, of course, that can be done on the theoretical front, particular thinking about network evolution and evolvability. But ultimately, the bottleneck there is going to be maintaining connection with the experiment so that predictions can be falsified. I think it's robust on logarithmic scale, because what's going to happen is various prefactors are going to change. But, I think the scaling will stay, and certainly the balance between the two quantities will stay. Sorry, it'll take a minute of shuffling here, but I'll find exactly the right transparency. It comes in right here. Right? So this is the factor. Think of this as, this is a lac repressor. Right? This is the operator site. And the statement is that the operator site has to be under control of the repressor. Well, it is not an assumption. This is, in theory, it's a variable which you try to optimize. Right? You can imagine the factor being more specific or less specific, and then a little calculation will tell you what happens to the probability of failure. Failure being defined as the probability of losing the control of the operator due to a mutation, or alternatively, acquiring an interaction with some other site on some other genes, and repressing some other genes. Right? There is some chance that there is some bit of string, just upstream of glucose operon, which if it stumbles into the domain of binding of a lac repressor, it will be repressed, and that's very bad. Right. It's really balanced.
Yeah. One effective way to control the size of a circle is just by changing the
concentration
itself. Why does it have to go all the way to
No. Specificity is that concentration. Point is, if you put in enough...
Correct.
In
the talk you made, you're fighting against the fraction volume of the Einstein
problem. For a fixed, yes. For a fixed concentration.
Yeah, but in naturality and other few sort of energy natures that people have determined, there is normally the NMT for the phase, which is very specific. There's only one body
size. Yes.
Wait.
Let's distinguish this. You know, so very specific. Now there may be one binding site in the genome, but the genome does not contain the 4 to the 18 sequences,
yes.
Right?
Yes. But it would be falling way down and all.
Yeah.
Correct. But then
the specificity
is just about the same. Looking at energy matrix,
it's about the same as the cap. No, absolutely not.
No,
it is.
Energy, they measure the energy. So they know
the.
There are these two cases
there.
What are a few more?
Maybe 3 or 4 cases. I'm having trouble with that. Yeah, so I think what you're saying is no. There was certainly one assumption that I did not emphasize, even though I should have. Right, which is basically the statement that this binding energy comes a little bit from lots of sites,
right,
as opposed to have one position which delivers most of the energy. Right. So the statement is that there are many sites that sort of contribute comparably. Because, technically this is buried in the continuum limit, right? If you start having sort of large gaps in your sort of energy spectrum, right, we should not really be thinking about continuous distribution and fine. You can. I think this assumption is less valid for very specific factors. So ultimately, you can certainly imagine a factor so specific that it will not be in that limit. But we were more interested, right? In any case, we have very little to say about these very specific factors. We're more interested in the factors which have 10 binding sites or 100 binding sites. So that's sort of the range in which one may hope to make progress. You know, these very specific things, you can't say anything.
So the assumptions that you made, were they made to make the problem be analytically practical, or are they made to make it computationally practical? In other words, if you went an undigitized all of things, basically, made binary, and now did it not analytically, but by computation, would that
right.
be?
Yes.
Would that just become impossible, or is that
no? I think it will be computationally tractable. I mean, this was done to actually have some analytic insight. Yeah.
I guess, I mean, the obvious question is when one does that, is there any possibility that some of the conclusions that come out of it, that you may get outside the range of what you've seen?
That would certainly be worthwhile doing. And, yeah.
Maybe at some level you covered this, and I kind of missed it, but what assumptions, I mean, how does the structure of your G of F, your logical expression affect any of these conclusions or maybe these conclusions? I mean, how typical, I mean, are these G of F?
Well,
well,
you see, I pulled the fast one on you. I defined this thing in full generality to be able to really think about different architectures, and then well, we did think about different architectures, but at the end of the day, as of now, we don't know how to tie it in with the experiment. We just don't know enough. You know, I'm very interested in suggestions. But so in order to make contact with you know, the data, we ended up thinking about these simple networks. And the key point there is to say that they're non-redundant. And if they're non-redundant, then every link under some condition is important. And then the problem trivializes. But the flip side of this is actually very interesting. You will say that, of course, one way of getting things very robust is to make things very redundant. So for example, why don't you find many response elements, right? Sort of hooked up as an OR, so any which one will work. And the problem is that this redundancy is unstable in evolution, right? The moment you have redundancy, then you're not directly selecting on it. So, right, if you have these two binding sites, either one of which will do, one of them is perfectly free to wander away and disappear. And at the end of the day, you will still be left with the same robustness, right? The same asymptotic stability. And then, you know, the big question is there some clever mechanism by which the cell is maintaining redundancy? So, for example, you know, one scenario is sort of inflationary, right? You have this working network, and you just duplicate, right? And well, you'll be constantly generating this redundancy, and then, you know, some of these sites will be drifting away and becoming useless. But you keep on making more, and then of course the size of your genome is going to grow very badly, and then you have to ask, is there some clever way of snipping sites out, you know, deleting sites in such a way that you're deleting non-working sites preferentially.
Do what you've done is to use models that are analytically practical because stuff and put it to the computer and make general conclusions about things. And they worry a lot about using non-analytic models because then you can't explore all the parameters they can get through. And I guess the reason I asked the preceding question is the point we were just talking about seems like the case where the analytic model in a sense is losing into thinking. So there's a difficulty there for the continuum model,
why not? Well, I guess on the philosophical level, we are not in the least constrained by analyticity. We'll basically do anything that's necessary. So that is not a constraint. So indeed, if we decide that right, it is the continuity of that is essential for something, such as maintenance of redundancy. We'll work with a continuous model. That's no problem. But I would still quibble with this because if you say that there is a difference in fitness between 3 and 2, well, it is saying that the thing is non-redundant. It is saying that, that 3 is not equal to 2, that you should just maintain 3 binding sites.
Right, but in a digitized sense, the organism did not. I mean, I guess that's what I mean about digitization, because in a digitized sense, they are redundant. If 2 has lower fitness, it's 3, but it's still a lot. Right? If you basically define fitness as being 1 or being 0. Right? But then,
well, you see, on this level, I don't think it will change very much because, if instead of looking at this diffusion in, sort of the square well, right, you will do a diffusion in some sigmoidal thing, you'll ultimately end up with the same conclusion that, the probability of getting out of, right, so diffusing out depends on the volume of the phase space inside. And that, the prefactor will be different. But that sort of fundamental relation between the specificity and will survive. Well, look, I think the message is very simple, that the phase space counts. That whatever you do, if you have a system with larger phase space at the same fitness, whether discrete or continuous, it will be better. Right? To the extent, if you say that the fitness depends on the sequence, directly, depends on each base, right? Then we're sunk. If you say that, this is the question about the fitness, if the fitness is really a function of the sequence, then there is nothing to do. But if you say that the fitness is the function of the binding, and binding depends on the energy, and energy is, right, mapping of lots of sequences into a very narrow range, right, then right, you've introduced this notion of phase space and of essentially neutral phase space, and I think that's survives, quite independently of whether this fitness profile is a square well or bell shape.
We're doing a discussion over lunch.